First Contact with Lori Siegel is a production of Dot 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 Media and iHeartRadio.
The moment that I can remember where I most felt the pain and pressure of all that was in my last year as CEO. And I was just standing there and my wife thought I left for work and then found me standing by the door and I like had tears in my eyes. She's like, what's going on? And I'm just like, I can't go in there and be that person today.
Yeah, I mean, what an extraordinary thing to just be sitting at your front door not even being able to open it.
I remember the moment so clearly because it was like I was looking at the doorknob and I couldn't figure out how to make my arm. It just wouldn't move. And I could just feel my body was just telling me, you know, this is not working for you.
Have you ever left something that was so tied to your identity, you wondered, who am I without it? A job? Maybe a relationship? You just heard Yancey Strickler talking about leaving Kickstarter. He's one of the co-founders, and for 5 years, he was the CEO. Oftentimes, shedding an identity is where a lot of the magic happens. Who you are and what you actually stand for becomes a little more obvious. At least it has for Yancey. I've known him for many years, so I'm going to throw out a couple words to describe him. Quiet, thoughtful, and a little punk rock. Now he's in the midst of stepping into his own identity without the backbone of Kickstarter. Yancey left Kickstarter in 2017, and immediately he started thinking a lot about what we value as a society and how those values define who we are as individuals. He wrote a book on it. It's called This Could Be Our Future. He calls it a manifesto. The book outlines an exercise that's worth trying out. It's called the Bento Box, and it's meant to keep us grounded and, most importantly, true to our identity. I want to start this podcast with one of my favorite Flannery O'Connor quotes. She writes, "A story is a way to say something that can't be said in any other way, and it takes every word in the story to say what that meaning is." To hear why Yancey cares about what we value, to understand his manifesto and its meaning, I think you have to go back to the beginning. You gotta understand his story, from growing up on a farm to punk rocker to building a tech company that transformed creative communities around the world. It took us every word to get here. I'm Lori Siegel, and this is First Contact. Okay, so welcome. The podcast is called First Contact. And what I love to do with our guests is talk about my first contact with our guests. And you, Yancey, I found one of our last on-camera interviews, which was me at the Kickstarter headquarters. And it was, I'll go to this one because I think it was kind of significant. I mean, all of them were significant.
Sure. Every interview is special.
Yeah, because you're up until a couple of years ago, the CEO of Kickstarter. And, like, really created, I would say, like, at the forefront of crowdfunding. Like, people didn't even know the word crowdfunding until you guys came along.
Yeah.
But I remember sitting in the Kickstarter offices in Brooklyn. It's like a pencil factory.
That's right.
And it was when you guys were announcing that you were becoming a public benefit corporation, and you did that with me. We were sitting at, like, it almost felt like a picnic table or something.
Yeah.
And it was like you were fundamentally changing the structure of your company to say, like, we're not just going to be about money. We're going to be about doing public good. That's, like, the idea behind B Corp, right? That was that moment.
Yeah, it was we'd always been a very mission-oriented company and very present in the halls and rooms of Kickstarter, but we never really articulated what that meant. And the tech environment that was about hypergrowth and raising a lot of VC, and there's a Silicon Valley template that we just turned our back on from the beginning, just felt strongly that raising a lot of money would just be a compromise. But we were still, like, existing in that world while being the weirdos in that world. And then we learned about the PBC format. And we learned about it after Patagonia did it. Patagonia reincorporated from a classic C Corp to a PBC and created a dual mission of financial purpose and non-financial purpose, basically.
Well, I guess if I could kind of go back to, like,
the root of that is what you were kind of saying, which is like, well, you know, this is like this hyper growth period. It was weird when you guys did it. Like, let's just take a step back. Like, yeah. It was like a weird move. I remember sitting in the CNN newsroom being like, what is this? They're changing structure. Like, okay, they're not going to be all about profit. This is before the conversation that like Silicon Valley companies are way too much about profit. Like, are we ruining the world? Like, it was before a lot of that. And you as an individual, we'll get into this. You've always been like a little punk rock,
yeah,
and a little anti-establishment, but Kickstarter itself always felt a little bit punk rock and anti-establishment. I would say, as someone who's interviewed founders for a very long time, they kind of embody their founder.
Yeah.
And I think it kind of embodied like who you are and where you come from, which was, did I read like you grew up on a farm?
I did. I did grow up on a farm. Uh-huh. I grew up evangelical Christian. You know, uh-huh. I'm from the country. I'm a country boy. Mm-hmm. But I didn't. Even as I grew up in that and was a part of that, I knew it wasn't me. Like, I knew I didn't fit in. And during high school, I got selected to go to a magnet school in Virginia, where they picked like a couple kids from each school to go to like a gifted school. And that was my first time being around other people that felt like me. And it really changed my worldview and made me aware of this larger world. But yeah, I mean, I grew up wanting to be a writer. I had no entrepreneurial desires whatsoever. And Kickstarter was just that it, you know, when Perry Chen, who first had the idea for Kickstarter, you know, we started working on it together because it was just like this fun secret project to work on. This is in 2005, like a very different era of the internet. Like, you had to have a room at the rack of servers somewhere to like do anything, which we were incapable of doing. But it was just really being driven by this idea that for funding creative projects, the only projects that a movie studio or a book publisher will fund are things they think will be hits. But most ideas are not going to be hits. They just want to exist. And there was no economy existed for those things. And so we were driven by this idea of like non-financial motives for creating creative and artistic work. And like, that was the vision for Kickstarter.
I want to go back to, just because like, even when in the book you write about like going to church where people are dancing in the aisles and speaking in tongues. Like, I think of like all these tech founders like growing up and going to Stanford and having kind of like a very different upbringing than you. And I read that your dad was a waterbed salesman.
Yeah, that's right. So when I was growing up, like from the mid-70s to 2000, my dad was a traveling waterbed salesman. And so he would go out on the road every week. He always brought his guitar. He's also a country singer. Mm-hmm. And he would sing songs and then go sell waterbeds. And he was doing that in the Bible Belt in the 70s and 80s. Yeah, now he's like a bedding salesman in the mall in Virginia. Mm-hmm. So like, I have some words for Casper. all the podcast ads, like, you know, taking down salesmen and middlemen. I'm like, that's my dad, and he knows a lot about beds. So step off.
I guess I would say, like, well, so watching him and watching what he did, you know, what did that do for you and kind of the person you would become?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that, like, my mom is a secretary at a college. There's a weird way that I'm an amalgamation of these two human beings. I mean, they divorced when I was very young, so, like, I have no concept of them together, really. But I could see how I'm a mix of these things. Like, I'm definitely the son of a waterbed salesman. And that I know
what does that even mean?
Just know how to talk. You know, a waterbed salesman is going to be able to talk someone into anything, you know. And then my mom is just, like, a wonderful, smart Christian woman who like reads books like nobody's business and did the crossword every day. And I'm her son in so many ways. You know, coming from this background was a source of anxiety for me, for, you know, especially coming to New York after college, and like, people here are very pedigreed and come from lots of backgrounds, and I feel like a country boy, you know. And so there's like a little bit of that culture shock. But over time, I've grown to see the benefits of that, the benefits of coming from a different place. Because I think a lot of the instincts that I have and that are part of Kickstarter, it's this mix of like kind of Christianity and punk rock together. You know, the church I grew up in, like, wealth is something dangerous. The Bible talks about it's easier for a camel to pass through a needle's eye than it is for a rich man to go to heaven, right? The notion is like wealth produces selfishness, produces a less giving kind of person. And so that's the water I was grown up in. And that was just like the table stakes that you're taught. And punk rock has similar sorts of ethos about, you know, being true to your community. And so you know, I got pulled into the business world through the circumstance of Kickstarter, but I think it's those values that also made us successful, just made us clearly different, and I think let the creative community trust us. If someone puts a project on Kickstarter, we get 5% of what they raise. We take no ownership. The Peak Design projects, the Pebble projects, they've made more money through Kickstarter than the company has. To me, that's a great sign of success.
When you say punk rock, I mean, I remember for me, maybe this is why I started covering technology back in like 2009. Kickstarter launched in 2009. Yeah. I remember I grew up in the South. I remember being the girl that would go to the punk rock shows alone sometimes. Mm-hmm. I loved punk rock and ska bands and all this kind of stuff. And there was something very punk rock about technology back in 2008, 2009, that second wave of tech. It was people who didn't fit in the lines, who didn't believe you had to do things just because they said you had to do them. And it really felt like that mentality was very there. So I think I could almost see, I could kind of see the parallels between people who were outsiders and who didn't fit really kind of being attracted to this world that all of a sudden became incredibly corporate and incredibly mainstream, so much so that we have to have these real interesting conversations now. But back in the day, it was kind of like another iteration of punk rock.
Yeah, it was like the internet was a blank slate. You know, it's like we can rewrite and redesign everything. There's like the John Perry Barlow, you know, very utopian vision. And I think Kickstarter is an example of that mindset. I mean, the notion of a trust-based system where millions of dollars change hands and it's like all about future ideas. I mean, it's such an optimistic product and really like believing in the goodness of people. And the internet just seemed like, it's going to enable every type of model. And instead, because of the huge influx of capital, very quickly the internet just settled on this business model of data-driven advertising and, you know, just a very small suite of possible ways to survive.
That you talk about, I mean, growing up and actually literally being on the bus and having people put gum in your hair and like say homophobic things to, I mean, say really terrible things to you.
Yeah.
Why is it that you just didn't fit? I guess this is a question I ask a lot of people that go on to do something big. The one thread, maybe, like people always ask, like, what's one thing that a lot of successful people have in common? And I'm like, well, they definitely kind of like were weirdos or didn't fit when they were younger. Like, why do you think you didn't fit?
I mean, if you saw a picture of me first day of sixth grade, maybe you would know. Like, I'm wearing plaid shorts and a plaid shirt and a fanny pack.
You're still kind of weird. Isn't your like photo now? You're kind of barefoot.
Yes,
you're still kind of a weirdo.
It's true. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's something deep. I mean, I spent a lot of years trying to get rid of it. I mean, once I started going to public school in sixth grade, like, I really felt like an outcast. And I remember every year, like, New Year, you go buy clothes, and I'm just buying all the most normal things I can. Like, I'm trying to dress like everyone else, and it never worked. And I was just like, what? Like, I'm wearing the same thing as him, but yet you call me a name, and, like, he's cool? Like, how did I...
All the normal clothes just, like, looked different on you?
I don't know. I think it was just that people could see deeper. Yeah. They could see deeper than I wanted them to. And then it's like that magnet school moment where I, like, accept that for the first time rather than trying to run from it. So for most of my life, if I could have programmed that out of me, I would have. Now I've reached a point in my life where I'm so grateful that I have those things and that I've sort of grown into them. Yeah, I mean, I've a lot of anxiety, a lot of self-consciousness, and those things are still there, but I'm, you know, I have a better handle on them now.
Is there a moment? For me, it's Bobby. I'm not going to say his last name. I'm just like, I remember Bobby. Like, I remember... Parents are going through a divorce. I'm at a roller skating rink, and I went through unfortunately a larger phase. And Bobby and him screaming like fat girl, what's she gonna do when she comes for you? To this day, I remember that, and just wanting to like curl up into a ball and just like not be there. Is there a moment that you could remember that like you can go back to that is just like...
Thank you for this, by the way.
You are welcome.
I'm gonna have to call my therapist after
this.
You
are welcome.
Yeah, no, there was. It was riding the bus to school, and it was a boy named Bubba who always sat on the back of the bus, and it's just him screaming slurs at me, and one day spitting skull on me, and then throwing a can of Coke at me. And I talked to my mom about this, about what the bus was like for me, and her advice was to just ignore them and to pretend it's not happening. And so I just sat there, not moving, while this guy's yelling at me. And Yeah, it's the smallest I've ever felt, you know, and that period of life feels so eternal. You know, the idea of ever getting outside of it, you know, just seemed impossible. And it was really hard. I didn't know how to deal with it. I think I buried myself in books and just kept my head down and tried to not be noticed. But it was very, very tough.
But you did, right? And you moved and you made the move to New York City and you became, we both have the Village Voice in common. I did not work at the Village Voice, but I remember it was my dream to work at the Village Voice. Weirdly, I remember coming to New York City and handing over my resume. I walked in there, hand over my resume, and I never heard anything. I'm still waiting for that call. I don't think they're with us, so I'll be waiting for a long time. But you ended up working at the Village Voice for
I freelance for them. Yeah, I mean, my first job was as a radio news reporter, and I was rewriting news blurbs so that they were 60-word things that a DJ would read out on air. Yeah. And my editor was a big fan of the New York Post, and so all of our stories had to have puns as their headlines. And so the only story I remember reading was an article about, it was J-Lo. This is like 2000, 2001, peak. I mean, now it's a new peak J-Lo, but first peak J-Lo. And she was saying that she regretted, she'd once talked in an interview about her butt. And she said she regretted this because now everyone talked about her butt. And I titled that story Dairy Error. And that's that's my journalistic peak right there. But yeah, I mean, I moved here and I just got jobs writing about culture, film, music. And I mean, it was all I ever wanted to do. And I had 9 years here freelancing, having day jobs in editorial organizations. You know, but probably the best job out of all those was still like the job where I had to rewrite a dozen news stories every day into 60-word blurbs. I mean,
why?
Because it was such a factory that you just had to churn out. I had to churn out 6 stories by noon and another 6 stories by 4. And I had a good editor who would cut out everything that was bad or unnecessary. And so it just teaches an economy of writing and thinking. It teaches you what's important. You know, it's just like that deep end kind of work of like all your little cute tricks, no one cares. You know, here's how you do this. And it's, I think the writer I am today is still because of that.
We've got to take a quick break to hear from our sponsors. But when we come back, why the company's success freaked out Yancey and made him question everything. You know, I don't think a lot of people remember. Interesting tech comes, and people kind of, you know, scoff at it, and everyone's like, no. And then all of a sudden, it's like, we can't remember life without it.
Yeah.
I remember, you know, covering Uber back in the day. And Airbnb, I was like, no one is going to order or get into a stranger's car. No one's going to live in, like, a stranger's home. No one is going to ask strangers to pay, ask for money on the internet. Like, I think we forget that we all shook our heads at this. And I think people forget about this whole phase of, like, you had to be crazy enough and had to have enough resilience to just go out there and continue to be crazy enough to do this. Crowdfunding didn't really exist before Kickstarter. I mean, there were ideas like this, but really Kickstarter was the first way that we really made this idea of crowdfunding mainstream, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's like a sort of utopian knowledge. If only we could all pitch in and do something. And, you know, we normalized it. And we create a platform that had trust, that there was a sense of validation by someone putting a project on the site. And it, you know, just sort of perpetuated itself.
But take me to the specifics. What was it like when you guys sat around and you're like, okay, we're going to ask people to ask for money and see what they say? Like, what were those initial reactions like?
Yeah, I mean, Perry had the idea in 2001, and we met in Brooklyn where he was working as a waiter at like a cool restaurant, and I was a regular there, and we became buddies. And
Why
did we become buddies?
Yeah, was that when people talk to each other in public places?
Yeah, it's a long ago when people used to do that. Yeah, we just have a similar sense of humor, sensibility, just could just feel that we clicked. We ended up, we both loved the same MBA team, which is how we really started talking. And then at the time, my day job was at a company, eMusic.com, the first like music subscription service. And because I worked at a company that had .com in its name, I think that made me the most technical person and maybe encountered that like seemed to buy into these ideas. And so, yeah, he pitched the idea to me. The first time he pitched it to me, I actually didn't like the idea.
Take me to the pitch.
So we're sitting in my living room, and I was in Greenpoint.
So you invited him home.
Yeah, okay. I invited him back to mine and put on some music.
What music were you listening to? Who knows?
Probably some Ethiopian jazz.
Okay.
Crack a couple of beers. And
okay.
I think he made me sign an NDA before he told me.
Smart man.
Yeah, and yeah, he just talked about this notion of like fans coming together to fund things and like people voting for what they wanted to see in the world. And my response was, this sounds like American Idol. And in like in a bad way. This is like, you know, Ruben Studdard, peer, and no shade on Ruben, but sort of like peak.
Shade on Ruben.
Peak American Idol. And I was just like, who needs this? Like I like institutions. I like gatekeepers. And Perry flipped it on me just saying like, well, it's not about the mass stuff. It's about like the niche stuff. It's about the sculptor in a small town that no one living there gets their work, but the internet, they're appreciated. And like, how does that person do something? And like, that's who we speak to. And, you know, that I immediately understood, just like, you know, I love David Lynch, and if I could give David Lynch money to do anything, I would. So of course, you know, I could see that. And, you know, we were so sure of ourselves early on. It's like the certainty of that you have when you don't know a lot. And then we go around telling...
That's a beautiful thing,
isn't it?
Oh,
it's wonderful. If only I could go back there. And then we'd go around and show people how much we knew. A lot of like, you know, y'all, what are y'all thinking about? I mean, the creative people we talked to really understood. Like the idea for the first Kickstarter project was to try to save Arrested Development. This was when Arrested Development was getting canceled by Fox. Fans were sending bananas to 20th Century Fox Studios to like say, put the show back on the air. And we're like, no, this is a Kickstarter project. This is what Kickstarter is for. The fans step up. And Perry went to college with the cousin of one of the stars of the show, David Cross, the comedian David Cross. And so Perry went and pitched David on like, let's save Arrested Development. Here's this thing. And David explained that clearly we didn't know how the entertainment industry worked because there's no way anyone would go for this. But as an artist, he loved the idea. And he's just like, I'll invest. And so the very first investor in Kickstarter was David Cross. Most of the early angels were creative people, musicians, like people who ran labels, people who ran magazines, like people who understood that problem. When we spoke to more traditional investors, there was a much higher degree of skepticism, which you heard more of like, no one's going to give anyone money without financial upside. I mean, all any investor would say was great. So I get points on the movie. Like if I back a project, I own it.
Get like a mug or...
Right. We would say, no, you get a mug and your name in the credits.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, who wants that? I remember a very prominent VC telling us, there's already too much art in the world. Nobody needs this.
No.
Yeah. And so it's just
what
like...
No.
What did we say to that?
We're not moving on from that yet. What do you do when someone says something like that to you?
Well, you're just like, this meeting isn't going well. So this is, I just remember there was a moment where it's just like, you sort of let that hang in the air. And it's like, so, okay, well, you know, anyone you think we should talk to? You know, you're just like, let's try to get some value out of this.
But is that what you do? I mean, I guess because I think for a lot of other founders, you know, people don't understand even... people like you who've had a lot of success, like part of success is just having a lot of people be like, this is a terrible idea.
Right.
That's literally if I could code into success, it's people telling you your idea is shitty.
Yeah.
Did you ever kind of question yourself and be like, I am crazy?
Yeah. Yeah. I haven't stopped. yeah.
You know, you said in the book, the truth is everything is made up. What an interesting statement. He said, the truth is there is little order. The status quo persists because people continue to wake up and believe in these ideas each day. Or they're so deeply embedded, we don't recognize them as ideas anymore. And then you say, Kickstarter happened, and it showed me things were way more fragile than I was taught to believe. Not to create story time out of this, but I thought that was an interesting statement, a powerful statement. What did you mean by that?
You know, I grew up thinking that the world makes sense, that there's people in charge, that history is logical and a natural progression. And I just trusted in those things. And when Kickstarter started being successful, it freaked me out. It freaked me out because I kept waiting for, like, where's the five people with clipboards who come by our office and, like, make sure that we're allowed to do what we're doing? You know, just this notion that, like, we can put out this idea that we had made up and that people just believed in it and then it was real and now it was just a thing was just so strange to me. And it just made me feel less certain about almost everything in life. And I felt terrified by that for a while. And then eventually I came to feel a kind of like a superpower of that, of, well, if Kickstarter works this way, then other things work this way too. And that leads me to the conclusion that the world is far more shapeable than I've been taught to believe. And that I can fear that, or I can seize the agency in that and, you know, just try to use that as like workable knowledge. And yeah, I mean, it's something like the idea that we're just following ideas that previous people accepted. You know, it makes sense. Like if someone says that to you, you're like, sure. I don't know why that's relevant, but sure. But really feeling it firsthand just created a kind of before and after moment in my life.
Like there was Yancey before and then there was Yancey after.
Yeah, and the Yancey after, like, I had to adjust to that. I had to get comfortable with, like, the notion of having a larger power than you maybe thought and that has some responsibility. But, yeah.
Was that messy at all?
I think it's just part of what allows the company to be unique. You know, it just doesn't feel like we're following someone else's script. Because, like, you know, I felt so alienated from the business world. Like, as a writer who started working in companies, and I discovered that I was good in meetings and good at strategic thinking, and I was a good manager. And, like, punk rock me is, like, just so destroyed by the fact that I'm good at those things. Like, am I a sellout? I'm good. Like, my CEO likes talking to me, and should I feel good or bad about that? And I had to get comfortable with those sorts of things. And but yeah, that mix of, like, wanting to learn the tools of how to make an organization work, or, you know, having that more traditional mindset, but bringing a different value system to it. There's a best of both worlds there that if you can bring them together, it's powerful.
Maybe punk rock, you just understood human nature. Mm. You know, maybe that's part of being punk rock is kind of understanding the pain and joy of being human. Mm-hmm. You know, it's harder to stay punk rock when you become corporate, right? Did you struggle with that?
No, because we were our own thing.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's like all the ways we made things hard for ourselves.
I was about to say, you guys didn't do high growth. I'm sure that was hard with investors. No. You guys didn't become like the hockey stick growth Silicon Valley company. You stayed small. You were in Brooklyn, not Silicon Valley. I mean, I can imagine that was hard for you.
Yeah. I mean, it's, but they were, you know, weirdly, like that stuff gets harder when you compare yourself to external narratives of success, when you're like reading TechCrunch or whatever every day and you're comparing yourself to like other people that are going the other path and you worry, oh shit, are we like being passed by everyone doing the Reid Hoffman blitzscaling, you know? I mean,
what does that mean?
I mean, Reid's blitzscaling, the book about it, it's just like the idea of using capital as a weapon. You amass as much money as possible to block your competitors from raising money and you just outspend them and you get as big of monopoly as you can and then you sell it to Microsoft. You know, I mean, that's like, that's that success model. And we were not, you know, just weren't interested in that. And yeah, I mean, there are lots of moments where I would doubt that path. I mean, I remember I became CEO of Kickstarter in 2014 and my first month as CEO, two other crowdfunding companies raised like $60 million in VC money my first month. And it was like the blitzscaling idea where they're just going to outspend us. Mm-hmm. And immediately, like in all the categories that we served, like they're offering zero fee, they're offering whatever you want, just using that money as a moat to try to eat away at Kickstarter. And so there's this moment of like, do we have to do the same? If someone escalates, you have to match their escalation or not. And we end up deciding no, like we're on this path, like, the chips are going to fall where they may, but maintaining independence over the long term, like we just got to weather this. And so that, you know, that was a hard call. And weirdly, a lot of the pressure you get is also from employees. You know, your employees want you to succeed. Employees often want you to grow in the traditional ways, both for maybe they're imagining their own upside of like their stock or things like that, but also they're just like, you know, they're more in the trenches of facing off against competitors, and they want the company to be more cutthroat. And we're just like, no, that's not how you're going to succeed in the long term. So there's a lot of moments where you're trying to hold on to this more benevolent mission, this larger, bigger picture mission, and you're just facing pressures from all sides to let go, to bend those things. And I think leadership is about, you know, knowing how to hold on to those. While, I mean, there are moments where you do have to evolve, you know, you can't play the same script over and over, but still maintaining those values when everyone is telling you you're wrong is, yeah.
That's hard.
That's leadership.
And I think we can talk about it from a very high level, but when you're in it, it's such a different story, right? Do you have any specifics you could go to where you think about an example of?
Well, I mean, the external pressure, I mean, I remember the moment, like, I think it was within this 48 hours, there's these announcements of, like, one company raising $40 million, one raising $20 million. That was a real, like, am I allowed to do this job? Like, are we sure about this? I don't know, the moment that I can remember where I most felt the pain and pressure of all that was, I mean, it was in my last year as CEO, and I was really exhausted, and there was a day where I was going to leave my house to go to work, and I had, like, stood in my front door, and I just couldn't even lift my arm to open the door. And I was just standing there, and my wife thought I left for work and then found me standing by the door, and I, like, had tears in my eyes. And she's like, what's going on? And I'm just like, I can't go in there and be that person today. Like, I just don't know how to be the one who's holding all of these things, who's still sure, who still, you know, has the strength and energy to project all the things that I need to project. And the idea of stepping into that role was just like, filled me with a level of exhaustion that I'd never felt ever before. And that was, yeah, it was just about living up to what I thought an image I felt I needed to live up to. And also just like, just doing it for so long, you know, just pouring so much of myself into it for so long, because I was the Kickstarter guy for 10 years, you know, went to events, you know, the community guy, like always out there, always the press guy, always telling the story and always believing it to the deepest depths of me. And then that it ended up just like kind of emptying me out by the end.
Yeah. I mean, what an extraordinary thing to just be sitting at your front door, not even being able to open it, right?
I remember the moment so clearly because it was like I was looking at the doorknob and I couldn't figure out how to make my arm. It just wouldn't move. And I could just feel, my body was just telling me, you know, this is not working for you.
And, you know, identity is a funny thing. And I can say this having left a job of 10 years too. I was Lori from CNN who covered Yancey
totally.
From Kickstarter, right? And so when I left my job of 10 years too. And I remember leaving, writing the goodbye email, sending it to CNN's super desk, which goes out to every employee in the company, and waiting to hit the send. And I remember the amount of anxiety I had. I had to have my boss at the time hit send because I just couldn't do it. I was just like, because it was just like watching my identity go. Because it takes, and I think this is probably for anyone leaving a job. And by the way, and I say this is a smaller scale than you because you are the CEO and the creator of a company.
Yeah.
When you leave something, it's such a part of you. And it does mess with your head. I can only imagine leaving behind Kickstarter for you must have been an extraordinary thing for your head and an extraordinary thing for your heart.
Yeah, I mean, initially, you know, the plan was to stay on the board and, you know, be connected to the company in a different way. And then as we were, you know, Perry and I were doing the transition and all that was happening, it just, I just thought, rather than reorienting my emotional relationship to this, like, I don't know what's in there for me. And because the company's a PBC, like, my values are there. Like, we did this whole thing that's supposed to solve for, like, one of us being hit by a bus. So, like, maybe I just get hit by a bus. You know what? Maybe the right thing for me is to just move forward. And it was very hard to reach that place and to, like, let go of that identity. But in the end, the idea of half holding on to that identity seemed harder to me than just, like, I just have to blow it up. And yeah, I mean, it took a bit for to feel like that was had been the right thing to do. But, you know, pretty quickly I've found, I thought that I was going to leave and then just like sleep for 3 months. And instead I discovered like the very next day I had more energy than I had had in years. And I realized that I'd spent a decade filtering every thought I had through the organization, through the brand, through like what's best for the creators, what's best for the employees, what does everyone else need? And that I was suddenly in a place of hustling for myself. And that was so exciting, you know, to have that freedom of movement and action where I'd been such an organizational kind of leader. And I believe like that kind of servant leadership is the way to do things. I was just really surprised by the amount of energy I felt hustling for myself versus trying to manage this larger concept that I had responsibility for.
How did you feel your last day walking out?
Great. I mean, it was like
take me to that day.
Yeah. It was an all hands where, you know, I led always the company and I stood in front of them, the team and the board was there. Perry was there. And I said, I'm here to let you know that, this is it for me, you know, and that I'd made this decision, you know, with the board, and that Kickstarter is a small independent company in a world of giant monopolies, and that we have to have an extraordinarily high bar for success. And that I've been a very good CEO for the company, but like the company needs to keep raising its game, and that I could do this because I was certain that was going to happen. And I just believed so deeply in everyone there, and that like this had been the greatest honor and pleasure of my life. And, you know, people gave me a standing ovation and then I walked out. You know, it was very painful. I mean, that day I'm just like, what have I done? You know, I'm walking around Williamsburg afterwards being like, what did that really just happen? But it was right. And I could immediately go back to like, I went back to that Perry being in my house, showing me the first ideas of Kickstarter, and to think like this journey started there in 2005 and it ends with me here saying exactly what I want to the company, people giving a standing ovation, hugging all these people I love. And then I'm just, now what's next? And so I came to see that as like, actually, this is a wonderful story and I shouldn't feel shy or weird about this. Like this is, I did my part and I feel great about it.
And it led you to the next thing that you're doing now. I did read that there is one moment that you cried.
There's right? a moment that I cried.
There is a moment that you cried. You wrote about it on your website. It was in a deli.
Oh, yeah. That was true.
Sounds like you didn't cry saying goodbye to your employees, but someone cried over an egg sandwich.
Yes. Listen, I practiced my speech so many times to make sure I wouldn't cry. I mean, the morning I gave that talk, I was sitting in my house reading my speech to my dog and crying like you wouldn't believe. But I had to get it out because if I cry while saying that to the company, then it's like, what is this? So I had to empty myself. Yeah, a few months after that.
That is so powerful. I mean, you have to think about this like you just practice. I can just see you practicing a speech of saying goodbye to this thing, to your dog, and just tears. That's unbelievable.
I had to get it out. Yeah, and then 4 months later, I decided to leave New York. I've been here 20 years and just felt like I can't start a new chapter in the same place where I've been. So with my family, we moved to LA and all kinds of goodbye parties, went to, you know, all my favorite restaurants again, et cetera, et cetera. It was all lovely. I had no emotional reaction. But my very last morning, I went to Happiness Deli on Broome and Ludlow, which is the deli where I've gotten an egg and cheese sandwich almost every morning for like 18 years. And I went in there to see the guys, to see Muhammad, and ordered my egg and cheese and told him I was moving. And like the three guys came out from behind the counter and each hugged me. And I'm just like there holding my tinfoil bagel crying. The only time I cried is when Mo and the guys, just sending me love, good wishes. You know, I met them when I was 21, moving to New York, you know, and so they've like known me for so long. When Kickstarter happened, they knew. When I came back to New York a few months ago for the release of the book, the very first thing I did when I got here is I went to the deli to give Mo a copy of the book, you know. So that was like, that was like my real New York moment of saying goodbye to the guys at the deli.
We've got to take one last break to hear from our sponsors, but when we come back,
We'll get into the manifesto Yancey wrote after he left the company. He also opens up about his struggles with being himself online. So you left, and you didn't. When you left, you didn't really know you were going to write a book, right?
No.
If I read correctly, you almost did some like business process in your head. You kind of put yourself through like the ringer a little bit, and decided that you would write a book, and not even just a book. It's not a memoir. It's not a business how-to. It is a manifesto, right?
Yeah.
Which I think is fascinating. So, tell us the premise. It's all about really understanding value.
So, I was searching for the next thing, and you know, starting in 2014, every talk I gave around Kickstarter was about this macro environment that we were in. Looking back, I'm like, I could tell that I was a little bored of the job when I only wanted to speak about larger forces and not the product of the company. But I'd given this talk just like explaining how the world had been overtaken by this belief that the right choice in any decision is whichever option makes the most money. And in doing research, I found the moment in time where I felt that that had happened around 1970 with a famous Milton Friedman essay about maximizing shareholder value. And so I gave a talk sort of telling that story and showing how like that's the reason why there's so many movies sequels. That's the reason why there are chains everywhere. It's the reason why Taylor Swift used to be on the cover of every magazine. And so like found this way to make something that's hard to see easier to see. So I just kept pulling on that thread and thinking about it, and then began this process of writing this book. And the book is called This Could Be Our Future. And the first half argues about this idea of this sort of the primacy of financial value and sort of tracking the history of that and showing how it's created. And then the second half of the book argues that we are in a moment where we are progressing to a new value system, and that the world where financial value is the only rational form of value is ending. And I call this way of seeing bentoism based on the Japanese bento box. And the word bento comes from a Japanese word meaning convenience. And because of the compartments and lid of a bento box, it lets you have a convenient and balanced meal, not too much of any one thing. And the bento honors the Japanese dieting philosophy of Hadahachi Bu, which says the goal of a meal is to be 80% full. That way you're still hungry for tomorrow. Mm. So bentoism is the same idea, but for our values and our decisions. And it's using the four spaces to argue that the world of value, the world of self-interest, the world we should be creating encompasses all these spaces, and that the mistake we've made over the past 50 years is believing that if we just maximize for this one value of financial value, that will just solve everything else. But the truth is that we've learned now it doesn't work that way. So an example I give in the book is about how Adele does ticketing for her shows. In 2014, Adele went on tour. When she goes on tour, all of her tickets sell out. Fans have to pay hundreds or thousands of dollars more on the secondary market to get a seat. So Adele was either playing shows for rich fans or for fans who weren't rich, but who were spending more money than they could afford to see her play. So Adele found a startup in the UK that had built an algorithm that would approximate the loyalty of her fans. It would analyze social data and like Spotify data, everything they could find to identify like here's the top 30 percentile Adele fans in whatever market, and use that as a way to invite those people to buy tickets. They could resell the tickets if they wanted to, but the thesis was that if we optimize for this like communal fairness value, this loyalty value, that a different kind of experience will be created. Mm-hmm. These shows were still profitable. She still like was in the black, but they were optimizing not for a financial value, but a non-financial value. And so like you're satisfying your financial needs, but satisfying the financial needs is not the point of the enterprise. The point is something else. Peter Drucker, like business guru of all business gurus, he calls this post-capitalism. The idea that the capital base, how much money you make, will no longer be what distinguishes like who's a market leader or who's most meaningful, but that instead we will build another set of values on top of just like the financial platform we're all standing on. And this is the moment in history where that is happening. And so all of our dashboards are going to be expanding over the next couple of decades.
I've asked Zuckerberg when I've interviewed him, is the business model broken? Is the business model broken? This is the question we ask every executive in Silicon Valley. Is this the right question to ask? Should we be asking an even larger question? Are these companies structured the right way? Are we doing the right value proposition? I mean, what do you think the question is?
Yeah, I think it's like, you know, maybe it's about value creation versus value capturing. I mean, we've assumed that creating value means keeping it for yourself and monetizing it. I think a shift like this happens from consumers demanding companies behave different ways and employees wanting to work at companies that act a certain way. And there being new role models and new metrics of success to work towards. You know, there's a world in which Facebook should easily be able to evolve in this kind of way. But what it requires them letting go of financial performance as the most important thing. It requires them letting go of like perpetual growth being the right thing. And basically it's imagining a different notion of success, and success being like long-term meaning and trust, and seeing that as like, there's the Simon Sinek just wrote a book about it, and there's the Jim Karst book about infinite and finite games, that we think business is a finite game, that at the end of every year we give out awards of the best performing businesses and that's it. But actually, like, no, it's an infinite game. It never ends. Success is survival. It's not beating your competitor. It's surviving. It's providing value. It's providing meaning. It's sticking around.
How do you apply this theory? I mean, this theory applies so broadly to everything, right? Tech is what I know. It's what I've lived and breathed my whole career. And it's what's incredibly personal to me. And I know to you, like, you've had the pressure from investors. You've seen the downside of not growing in a huge way. You've dealt with it from the inside. So how do you apply, you know, this idea of really maximizing for value, the things that's going to help us as a society? How do you apply this theory to Silicon Valley right now?
You know, the bento is a simple compass that allows for self-coherence. Like, the hardest thing I found as a CEO was, even if you thought you knew what to do, like, how do you stay true to that? How do you hold that in a moment where everything is telling you, everything makes your value seem irrelevant or wrong? And as silly as it seems, a piece of paper where those things are written down, a way that you're accountable to your staff to like make a certain kind of decision, those are the kinds of tools that make those choices a lot easier. And so how do you equip someone to make a better choice? And so we know it's important to think long-term. We know it's important to consider our impact on others, but it's especially in moments of fear, moments of anxiety, it's hard to reach for those places. And so I think of the bento as like a loving framework that acknowledges our weakness, that respects our weakness, and just says, hey, we know we want to be better people than this. So here's a tool that sets you on that path.
I can't let you out of here without talking about a piece that you wrote that I found fascinating, called the Dark Forest Theory. Mm. You, first of all, you're a tech company founder who struggles to be himself online, which I think is delightfully ironic and also very now, you know. Yes. I think all of us kind of struggle with this idea that these spaces, the internet as it was supposed to be, which is a place for us to connect and be ourselves, isn't exactly that anymore. Yeah. And I know for me personally, it's become very self-promotional. I look back at Facebook posts I did maybe a decade ago, and I'm like, God, I sound so much more myself than I do now. Mm-hmm. And so when you wrote this post, and you talked a little bit about this, and I want you to explain what the Dark Forest Theory is, it really resonated with a lot of people, myself included. So what is the Dark Forest Theory?
Yeah, so,
and how does this relate to this moment we're in right now?
So it started, I'm 41 years old, and I had this realization that I'm like a well-adjusted human being. We could sit next to each other on a plane and have a great time, but on the internet, I'm just like, could not be more awkward, and I don't know how to be myself, and I...
Why?
Well, I first wrote it off as like, the internet's stupid. Mm-hmm. People who are good at that are stupid. You know, I've just tried to like excuse myself being bad. And then I came to think, well, it's probably worth a little more self-reflection than that. And also just like, there's such a benefit to coming into yourself, into your own as a real person. Like, maybe there's an online version of that too. What would it mean to become that? So I had to ask myself, why can't I be myself? And it made me think of this book, this amazing Chinese science fiction book called The Three-Body Problem, written by this author, Xixin Liu. And there's this part in the book where a character talks about how when human beings look into space, we keep sending out messages into space and we don't get any response back, and we assume this means that we're the only ones here. But instead, this character asks you to think about this a different way, which is to imagine a dark forest at night. It also seems like there's nothing there. It's quiet, nothing moves. That could lead you to conclude that the forest is empty. But in reality, the forest is full. It's just that all the creatures have realized it's too dangerous to show themselves, that predators will find you if you stick your neck out. And I came to realize that I had the same feeling that, like, if I put my neck out, then you're going to get taken down by trolls. The advertisers will know more of your interest graph. You'll be exploited in all these ways. You'll be taken out of context. And it just feels, you feel very vulnerable and it's very dangerous. And so what we do instead is we don't put out our real selves on the internet. And instead we use our real selves in WhatsApp groups and private channels on podcasts, which feel less like the internet, and that the public sphere of conversation has really emptied out of real people being real. And instead, the social networks are full of bad actors. It's GRU trolls. It's advertisers looking to exploit you. It is you're kind of an idiot to stand out in those, because you're just there's so many people after you, right? You could easily take that mentality, and that this is driving people to be less and less real. And that this is dangerous.
Well, it's interesting because Mark Zuckerberg, he always does these New Year's resolutions that he posts on Facebook. And this year he decided not to do a New Year's resolution. He said he's not doing them anymore, but this is his vision for the future. And he talked about the future as privacy in these private networks where, it's kind of this nod to what you're saying. People don't feel as comfortable sharing publicly. And people are kind of going into these more private spaces, and the future is privacy. But what you're saying is, we got to be really careful with that, because you're creating this space for extremism and the louder voices that maybe we don't want to hear as much. And then all of us kind of disappears with that.
Right. I mean, you get into there's at this second, in this moment of time, the Twitter beef between Bernie Sanders supporters and Elizabeth Warren supporters, where right. It's who knows how many of these are real people, right? But yet there is this, we project what happens in these spaces and imagine that's what everyone must be thinking or feeling. Whereas the real, most real voices are not being heard. To borrow from Nixon, there's the silent majority that we don't really know what people are thinking and feeling. When I had this realization, I thought, well, shit, I need to I can't just let this go. I can't just accept this. So it made me try to be better at the internet. And so for a while I did. Every day I tried to tweet twice a day, and I'm like, I'm going to be not cool. I'm going to accept being uncool.
By the way, I love, first of all, can we just pull it back? You're an internet CEO, a tech CEO, former tech CEO, talking about how you had to force yourself to try to tweet two times a day.
Yeah.
I'm a former I still cover technology, but the former senior technology correspondent scene, and I feel like I would say I would have to force myself to try to tweet two times a day too. That's a painful process.
Well, it's even better as you do that, and you're and I'm not allowed to self-promote. That's the other thing you lay. But
how is that? How is that process for you?
Well, I only stop. I still self-promote all the time. It's good. It ebbs and flows. But one of my New Year's resolutions for this year was to step into my power more, to not be so considerate all the time.
Right.
And so kind of my theme song, I don't know if you know the Future song, Mask Off. but I'm trying to be mask off, just be more fearless. Mm-hmm. And there may be unintended consequences, but I feel like in my gut, it feels like a more value-creating thing versus me just hiding. And, I don't know. And I guess I'm assuming my opinions matter in some way by doing this. But I don't know. It didn't sit well with me, this idea that, I can't be real in this place where actually it seems really valuable to be real. Because, I knew as when I was a CEO, anytime I spoke to a peer CEO or read a post by someone that's really being honest about the challenges, I wanted to weep in gratitude that someone was sticking their neck out and saying what they really believed. And, here I was feeling fearful of doing that.
Well, it's this idea that if the internet is the town square, right, and the town square got overrun and crowded and people started going away from it, what does that town square look like now?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, right now it probably looks downtown Aleppo or something like that, right? It's just emptied. And the election's going to make that, even crazier.
I think it's incredibly important right now. You say you do the bento box theory with people.
Yeah.
I just want people to understand what this means.
Yeah, let's do it.
What does it mean? And could you just
do that with me? This is an exercise you give to people about understanding their values. So, like, put me through it, Yancey. Yeah. I feel like I've asked you questions throughout your career. I'm going to turn the tables a little bit. You're allowed to ask me some questions.
If I have a pen, I'll write, or we could just talk it through. So this is a process that I lead. There's a bentoism.org. You can go through this online.
Okay.
But I'm going to draw here a blank bento. And by doing that, I'm just drawing like a 2x2 box.
Okay.
And in the bottom left here is now me. And so this is thinking about, this is the most selfish part of you, the part of you that wants to be secure, that like likes pleasure, doesn't want to be told what to do. It's like the most selfish part of you.
Great. I see her there.
Yeah. And so the first thing is just to ask, what does now me want and need? Like when I just try to isolate that part of me, what do they say matters? So when I did this, things that come out are like good health, money in the bank, like working on things that are interesting to me. But I just sort of like, just like the basics of, if I don't have these things, I'm in trouble.
Okay, so I guess good health is important and money in the bank, not to steal yours.
Yep.
Work that matters to me and that fulfills me.
Yeah.
Great people who I surround myself with. Is that selfish or is that just kind of...
We'll get into people good, but that's good.
Okay, and should they be good or bad ones?
Either way. What's funny is that everyone like virtue signals in their bento of like all the ways they're great, and then
I know because I feel like some of them
they're all shadows,
but they're all
also shadows, right? They all also reveal what our faults are.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to speak to here is like when you're working on a project that's like really right for you. What kind of project is that?
It's definitely a creative project that's in line with my values. That's incredibly fulfilling, and I've left jobs for that. So I think that's incredibly important to me.
Okay. So deeper fulfillment is part of your now me.
Yeah.
All right. So now we think about future me. So this is, you have beautiful white hair, you're elegant, you have your health, you're doing Zumba every day.
Yeah, fabulous dresses. Generally, I do a Broadway dance class every so often.
Like the Times has already written your obituary and it says everything you want.
Perfect. I hope I get to choose the writer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What does that person tell you is important? So like every moment you face, that person leans in and says, Lori, here, I want you to remember this. So my answers to this were like, don't sell out, being loyal to my friends. I grew up a child of divorce, so like creating harmony between disharmony is like crucial for me.
Okay. So I think that I would go with that. I would say as someone who grew up a child of divorce, not to keep stealing yours, but I think that to creating a very, very healthy home environment, I was able to do that. I think that would be something. I was able to do right by the people I worked with.
So is that loyalty?
Loyalty. I did the right thing, if that makes any sense. Because I think there are always opportunities for you to not do the right thing. I did the right thing.
What about like being curious or learning?
I continued to learn. I think that's something. I think a lot of people get really stagnant. I think it's easy to just settle. And I think I continued to grow. And I took the risks, right? Like you continue to take risks throughout your career.
That's what she's telling you. Yeah.
Yeah. So I did the unpopular thing that ended up panning out.
Yeah. Yeah. You took the risk and you didn't look back.
Yeah.
Great. All right. So now two more. So now is now us.
Okay.
So now us, you're thinking about all the people in your life that really depend on you, really like an emotional relationship with. Okay. And what I'd ask you to think about is what's at the heart of your relationships? So when I did this, I like listed out all the people in my life and I suddenly realized, and I thought, what is at the heart of my relationships? And I suddenly realized that if someone texts me, it's like a 30% chance I'm going to write back.
Okay.
but like I could have a 5-hour dinner with them and never look at my phone once and like have this deep time. So like I'm like the hyper present friend in one ways, but also like a bad friend in other ways.
Okay.
So like what do you bring to your relationships, do you think?
I think I bring an extraordinary amount of loyalty to a select few amount of people.
Yeah, I can tell you a lot based on that. I'm similar. That's your shadow, by the way.
Okay.
Yeah. Not letting people in.
Well, good thing we only have 2 minutes left for this interview.
Yeah. Anything else for those? So loyalty with a small group. Are you adventurous? Are you the fun? Are you giving advice? Are you?
I think I'm the truth. I'm the confessional. I'm the one you can tell anything to without any judgment. I'm your first call in prison kind of friend.
Great. You know? That's a great first call from prison. Got it.
Yeah, I'm your kind of like I'm your non-judgmental. Like let's go there and like we got this kind of person.
Yeah, I'm gonna get your cell for if I need it later for something. And finally, so we have future us. So future us, you're. thinking about your children, if you have them, and everybody else's children too. But like that next generation, what mm-hmm. do they need from the world? My answers were like a world that's not on fire.
I was about to say hopefully one that doesn't currently look like Australia right now, which is horrible. I think they need from the world selfishly, I say this as someone who's genuinely concerned about the state of like technology and democracy. I think they need an open and caring environment that they can grow up in that's good for their mental health, and a place that's a little bit kinder than the one I think we're currently heading in.
That's great. That's okay. Great. Here I have in front of me, I've written down the things you've said, and they're like written in these different boxes. So this is like a map of your values and a map of your goals and priorities in life. And what I would teach you to do in a workshop is we would go through some real questions you're facing in your life right now.
Okay.
And we would sort of ask each part of the bento sort of give a yes or no answer. Like, does this in line with your values or not? And what I talk about is the goal is being self-coherence.
Okay.
Which is to be able to act in a way that you're always in integrity with all these parts of yourself. Hmm. Because the challenge of the modern world is like being a good employee means being a bad partner. You know, being a good CEO means being a bad parent. There's like these compromises that we take and that we just think are we can't get out of. But to me, this says that these are things that you actually can bring together, that coherence is possible. So to give you an example of a way to use this, it's like a practical thing is when the book came out, all I wanted to do was self-promote my book. I wanted to be like, I thought, who is my inner Gary V, Gary Vaynerchuk, and what would Gary do? And so all I wanted to do was to like, just do giveaways and just get attention on me. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, I know this is not like the best way to be thinking. So I wrote down in my notebook, I said, what should I do with my energy? And I drew this blank bento. And I've done my bento, so I know my values in each of these spaces. So I thought, like, now me, what does it want? And it, now me, was like, sweepstakes, get attention, like, let's go Facebook Live right now, you know, nudes, whatever it takes. But then the future me, which is about not selling out and creating harmony, is like, you need to read these three books. You need to learn more. My now us said, why are you thinking so much about the book? Like, you should create time with your wife. You should call this friend. And my future us reminded me of this larger project of bentoism and like, hey, the book's in the past. You got to think about these bigger things. And so I've started doing this as a weekly to-do list, to where normally a to-do list is like your errands and whatever work has to happen right now. Now my to-do list is filled with like schedule a date with my wife, read this book, call these friends. And it's like I'm forcing myself to use my time on a weekly basis on all of these things that matter to me. Some of these things I was already doing, but it's like I would be spending time with my son as a parent. And it's like I'm just waiting to get back to work. You know, it's like non-time. I'm thinking of that time as not valuable because it's not growing like whatever my ego is.
Right.
But instead, I now can accept that as like, no, this is valuable time. It's just in a different space of my life. Hmm. And so this has dramatically reshaped how I use my time every week. And it gives me agency. It gives me agency. And again, this phrase that I'd never been in my mind before, but self-coherence I keep coming back to is like, that's the place to be. You're just in integrity. And what we lack as a society is the self-coherence. We're not in integrity with our environment. We're not in integrity with our values. And this is the evolution that has to happen now. And so the bento is a framework to get there. And whether you buy that language, you know, is less important to me than really us coming to see the truth of these spaces and really the opportunity and responsibility we have to think about them all.
I was thinking about how to end this one, and I thought, why try to tie this up in a pretty bow? Startup life is messy, and having an idea that transforms communities and industries, that comes with a lot of highs and a lot of lows. Leaving a job that defines your identity is messy. So is staying in one when it's clearly time to go. I think you can hear that tension from Yancey. We are also in a similar moment in tech. We're trying to figure out our own identity in what Yancey calls a dark forest, where the loudest and most extreme voices are amplified. You could argue it's a pretty important time to understand our own values and what we value as a society as a whole, via bento box or however you want to put it. I'll leave you with that. For more about the guests you hear on First Contact, sign up for our newsletter. Go to firstcontactpodcast.com to subscribe. Follow me. I'm at Lori Siegel on Twitter and Instagram. And the show is at First Contact Podcast.
If you like the show, I want to hear from you. Leave us a review on the Apple Podcast app or wherever you listen. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. First Contact is a production of Dot 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 Media, executive produced by Laurie Siegel and Derek Dodge. Original theme music by Xander Singh. Visit us at firstcontactpodcast.com. First Contact with Laurie Siegel is a production of Dot 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 Media and iHeartRadio.